Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast.
You have chosen wisely. That's from a movie. An Indiana Jones movie. Movie about the Jesus' cup. Everyone thought it had gold and diamonds and stuff on it, but it wasn't. Because Carpenter wouldn't drink out of a chalice. Not even today. They haven't changed. Those Carpenters. They're not all the Messiah, though. Just the one. Well, I don't know. Maybe, though. Tell you what. If you're having any work done to your house, or if you're walking down the street and you get catcalled or hear a whistle, just check to see if there's stigmata. And if there is, you win! I would like to let you know that the Nerdist channel on YouTube has a new episode of Neil's Puppet Dreams. Neil Patrick Harris visits a doctor's office, and Nathan Fillion is there. So, two names that I think you might want to on the I haven't slept in a long time. I wonder if I'm going to remember this. I'm going to remember this intro. I would like to thank Samsung for being the sponsor of this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. All right. The Samsung Galaxy Note 2 has a 5.5-inch screen. That means you can watch movies on a 16:9 aspect ratio, which is how you want to watch movies. What you could do is set it up so that it's about 2 feet from you, and then set up tiny little puppets in front of you that you can be like, down in front. Like, you could pretend you're in a theater if you wanted to. Or just cut out tiny little Mike Nelson and or Joel, depending on where you fall in the MST3K camp and the bots, and just put tiny, and then just stick it right into the front of your Galaxy Note 2, and then write your own Mystery Science Theater. That's how much fun you could have. There's also the S-Beam feature. You can tap the back of another S-Beam-enabled device, and you can share large files in seconds. It's just like the phone's just like, mwah, kiss, and they have transmitted the phone. So the phones can make out and transmit images. And then the S Pen, which basically makes the device a virtual notepad. So there are a whole bunch of reasons. People are enjoying the Galaxy Note 2 from Samsung. Check it out. It is available now. You have no excuses. You might have some excuses, but in my mind, they're not up to snuff, because I'm using snuff as a word now. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is Dimitri Martin. And I've known Dimitri for a long time, and this was a really fun episode. It was really great to have him on because we were both practicing for our hour-long sets at the same time, and we would sort of pass each other at shows and be like, hey, how are you doing? And be like, yeah, well, I'm getting there. I'm not panicking, if that's what you're worried about. So it was really fun to actually have him come on and sort of do the post-mortem wrap-up of how it all went down. But generally just a sweet, funny guy. So here you go, the Nerdist Podcast number 292 with Dimitri Martin. And I will see you if you're going to be in Nashville at the shows at Zany's, or which would be the 6th or the 9th of this month, which is December, and then the following weekend in Chicago and Rosemont. And if not, then never mind this part.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Did you forget it?
I never got it. No one ever had it.
But
you
now.
You didn't see Laura?
Now I got it.
Get on your microphones.
You got to get up on it.
Podcast assemble.
Why does the podcast always fart? I don't understand.
It's a rickety old podcast. We got to.
I've been asking that question a lot. Why does the podcast always fart?
The smelliest podcast on the internet.
Dimitri Martin.
Hey.
I'm so glad you're finally on the podcast. I'm so sorry it took so long to get you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you on.
I'm psyched. I waited. I let it. We got it right. This is the exact right time.
I think it is.
Were you waiting a couple years just to make sure that it stuck around? You're like, I want to make sure it works out.
You know, I got to be honest. I'm like a late adopter. I like technology. I don't think I'm like a Luddite or anything, but I'm trepidatious about all this stuff.
There's kids now growing up that are rejecting technology. My friend was dating a younger girl, and she didn't want a cell phone, but opted out to get a pager.
What?
Because to her, that's like...
She wants to be a cardiologist.
She's like doing it old school.
In the 80s.
Drug dealers. You think about this generation, Facebook is something that people got to discover and opt into.
Right.
But the next generation's parents will be Facebook users. So I think of a lot of things my parents were into and they didn't seem cool. So it seems like there's a shelf life for a lot of these things.
Look for my new book, Opt Out. How technology is ruining our culture and why you don't have to take part in it.
Or they inherit the page that their parents created when their children were born.
Yeah, what are you going to do with your parents' Facebook page when they die? Well, I'm probably just going to digitally burn it.
My siblings and I are fighting over it. We're trying to figure out
how to divide up the...
I want the likes. Yeah. I want the likes.
Well, it's just like, I have more stock in Farmville than they, because I help them
My
create
dad's
that.
Farm is impressive.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be a post-tech generation, you know?
There's actually more people are reading books now than they have in the past few decades.
What? They hide it really well, though.
Yes.
What happened to all the knighthood invitations that that you would get in Facebook's early days? Where it's like, you've been bitten by a zombie. Pass it on. You have a knighthood invitation.
That's what made me like not get into it. Yeah. I joined it, and then it was all that stuff. Yeah. I was like, no, I'll stick with MySpace. I think it's the workhorse in this. Yeah. I think it's really going to stand the test of time.
Good choice. So how's your MySpace page doing?
It's great. I got so much blingy going on.
Yep.
Yeah.
Dimitri did a really great MySpace thing on The Daily Show.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah,
that was
that's right. That was
like
a long time ago. On MySpace.
Funny.
That's when all of a sudden you just had millions.
I remember the dilemma when I was doing the piece. I was like, well, I want to make fun of MySpace, but I can't make believe I'm not a user. But I don't want to be gross and promote my MySpace.
It's so funny.
And you found the perfect balance.
Perfect balance.
If you can watch
something
online
that disappeared,
anywhere.
Yeah,
please
yeah,
do.
Yeah.
Moot point number 55.
It's weird, though, because that's the fear of doing the kind of topical stuff or stuff that's relevant in the now, because, you
Everything's
know.
So digestible now. You don't even really worry about it anymore. It's
I'd like stuff to be able to stick
weeks.
Around, though, like a bit at least, you know?
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, imagine doing a bit about Honey Boo Boo, but in 5 years, you're going to be able to remember the show? Yeah. She was on another show, then she got her own show. Anyway, I was thinking about Honey Boo Boo.
I always strive for the most generic, seemingly timeless stuff, which there's no such thing, but I try to think. Do we have the same phone, Kate?
Feet, huh? Feet?
No, this is a visual thing.
No. I just have more of the red edges.
Yeah, I have a red phone case for anyone who's listening.
And
if
reviewing.
You're not listening, I also have a red phone case, but you don't know that.
I'm reviewing cases on today's show.
Are you?
Yeah, and I just read the script, and I was like...
You mean like Roe v. Wade, Plessy versus Ferguson?
Yeah. I mean, I give that case a 4 out of 5.
Speaking of reviewing cases...
Whoa, shit, dude, 5 out of 5.
No, 5 out of 5 is for Plessy versus Ferguson.
I feel like it's not timeless.
What about Kramer versus
Why
Kramer?
Why not versus with the legal stuff? Why the V?
It's for ratings.
Yeah,
it's for ratings.
It's for ratings.
It's for court ratings.
Well, you pay by the letter.
That's what it is.
Kramer v. Kramer.
But Dimitri, you actually have a law degree, don't you?
No, I dropped out after 2 years.
You dropped out of law school after 2 years.
I did 2 of the 3 years, and I bagged it.
Fuck this.
Rich Fulcher also did that.
Is that right?
Yeah, Rich Fulcher, I believe, went to law school and then dropped out and then never ended up telling his mom.
Oh, really?
It would have killed her.
Wow.
Yeah, and he even had a whole one-man show about keeping a secret from his mom.
That's amazing.
Visiting her, and then, things are great. There's a firm.
Your Honor, I object.
Yeah.
Order. Point of order.
Yeah.
So you went to law. You went to law school, and so where did comedy figure? Did you quit law school to do comedy, or did you quit law school because it was a horrible and oppressive?
No, I quit law school to do comedy, but I hadn't done it yet by the time I quit. I hadn't done an open mic or tried it or anything, but I was in New York, and it was near a couple of comedy clubs, and I was like becoming the kind of quote unquote funny guy in law school, which just equals annoying, you know, more annoying than the average law student I get. You know, I was trying to do bits or something, but I had never done stand-up, so I don't even, you know, I didn't know. But I went to like 2 or 3 live comedy shows. I went and saw stand-up a couple of times. And I liked, you know, I knew stand-up from TV, obviously, and I was a fan of stand-up comedy. But I liked joking around, and so I started just writing jokes, being like, all right, could I do this? So for a couple of months leading up to the first time I got on stage, when I was still in law school, I was writing some jokes. And
Your
I
Honor,
dropped out and I did it.
I have a pile of sworn affidavits here that claim that women go to the bathroom in groups.
That's right.
Oh!
It was all legal. On the night in question, Fat man was in a rowboat.
But I think there are, a couple of fields that where you see some of the tool sets that happen in comedy, which is, you know, to be able to look at a case and break it down and sort of figure out like what the essential quality is to create an argument and sell something to the hardest audience in the world, a jury.
Yeah.
You know, like I really feel like the guts of a comedy set are in there.
I think so. I think the idea of like assumptions, logic, you know, reasoning, building an argument.
What was your major in college?
People. I majored in history, but I would have done philosophy if I'd taken a philosophy course earlier. Later into college, I took a couple of courses in philosophy, and I was like, oh, I like this.
Because
those were like just short papers that you'd write, and it was, you know, it's what I found funny about philosophy was if you go historically through it, it's, okay, so this guy, here's his view of the world. Like, this is his argument. Like, he's basically saying, I figured it out, so we're done. And the next guy's like, really? Is that what you think it is? Because here's how you're wrong. Like, this is the theory of the world, like I fucking nailed
and,
it.
And so, like, what's so fun about, because philosophy was my major, and so what's so fun about philosophy is that, you know, you look at these philosophers and you sort of look at them like scientists in a way, but they're really, they're not dealing in real science.
Right.
They're just thinking really hard about things that people hadn't, which now we take for granted. Like, well, everyone fucking puts their opinion about what's what on the internet. Like, but there was a time when people just sat around and tried to deconstruct everything we know, and they became famous for that.
Totally, and there, it's such a confidence game. You know, how many comics have we all seen? And some of them, they just bulldoze an audience. It's like a confidence game. You just like leave the show, and you're like, "What just happened? That guy didn't even say anything." But he was so confident. Like, he sold me this snake oil, this bullshit on stage. I mean, it's just entertainment, but philosophy doesn't seem that different than it. Not that it's all bullshit.
Sure.
But yeah, it's that confidence is such an important generator to the whole thing. You know, science, yes, I guess confidence is involved in science, but there's a scientific method. And
you still have to back it up with facts.
You have to back it up. Stand-up is, you know, it's nothing.
Where, with philosophers, it's like, well, there is no abstract reality, really. Well, reality ceases to exist whenever you blink your whenever you're not observing it.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
And they'll be like, the categorical imperative. And you're like, oh, okay.
What now?
Those are fancy words.
What just happened? Wait, so is there a world when I'm sleeping or is there not a world when I'm sleeping? That's what I really want to know.
Those guys were just trying to get laid, and they probably were pretty successful.
I'd imagine so.
Women would be like, wow, you're smart.
I never thought about your dick like that.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, big to me isn't necessarily what big means to you. How do we know that this concept of wide really is the same concept?
Time doesn't exist. So if you're a virgin now and we have sex, you're still a virgin.
You're still a virgin because you need time to tether your virginity to reality.
That's right.
So it doesn't really matter.
Women seem to have gotten screwed in the whole philosophy thing. I don't remember studying many female philosophers.
Well, I don't think culture and society really took them seriously, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
It's like
totally marginalized.
Completely.
Probably some amazing philosophy came out of the ladies, and it was just...
And
that sounded
ladies, you have any philosophy? I didn't think so. How about the ladies?
Well, Aristotle came out of a lady.
That's right.
It's true.
All philosophy has come from ladies.
The ladies of philosophy. Is it a shoe?
Coming to the theater near you.
Why is it that all ladies empty their bowels in the bathroom troughs at the same time?
My bad.
Why is she a proper British lady?
I don't know. Why couldn't she be a proper British lady?
I'm trying to adjust my seat. Do you guys know how to work these seats?
Yes, there's a handle underneath.
Where do you want to go, higher?
Just believe.
A little bit
lower. Can you take him
higher? This chair is like a great metaphor for the diminishing returns of like our technology.
That a chair
can... I mean, the chair was pretty well figured out a long time ago.
It was fine.
It's like, all right, your legs go about this long and... we'll do it this height, and there's the back, and you sit in it. You're good, you know?
You know, so many people use the phrase, don't try to reinvent the wheel, that it makes me want to try to figure out how to reinvent a wheel.
It's true.
It sounds like a challenge.
You know what? If you're not getting, I mean, who does this? But if you have time later and you're bored, you should Google, I think it was on designboom.com. It's one of the sites that I like. It's like a design blog.
Mm-hmm.
This guy did kind of reinvent the wheel, in as much as this student, I think in Europe, some design college, he made a collapsible wheel, and they had pictures of it and stuff. It was awesome. It was awesome.
For bikes,
I can't visually describe it well enough, but it was like, imagine like two halves, kind of two semicircles from what I remember, with like a hinge on the middle of each arc, each chord, whatever it is, geometrically.
Yeah.
So you kind of pull it apart, and then you can squish it down.
Hmm.
And it would be like just squishing a circle. But somehow, when he locks it all together, it's structurally sound.
Oh, okay.
And you can ride the bike. I would be freaked out probably.
Sounds like it's going to be on the next Dyson vacuum.
I'm always afraid of just the fucking wheel falling off when I'm riding a bike. That front wheel just going down.
Yeah.
Like if you, 'cause it's weird when those bikes where you could just, you know, have the front wheel take it off so easily.
Yeah.
I don't like that. I need to be able to fucking get like a, you know, just bolts and just make it so it doesn't move.
So you don't topple
you
over the handlebars.
And chances are that's happened. I mean, just there's so many people have bikes. There's so many of those wheels.
Lots of people filming people on the internet.
Statistically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Statistically, it's has to, you could be one of those guys.
Yeah. It's very scary.
Jonah just hits parked cars on his bike.
I did it once.
Did you?
Yeah.
Out of anger?
No. I was riding my bike home with Deanna, and I was going faster than her, and I turned my head and was like, hurry up, slowpoke. And then I looked forward, and like I was kind of too close to a car to really just turn away, and just went like, and then right and broke off the side view mirror.
I did that.
Yeah?
I did that in New York. I did that. I had a scary stretch. You know, when you have distance from something you've gone through, you get it. You can define it a little bit better and understand something was going on, even if you don't know what was going on. But in the course of a week or 10 days or something, I had two really bad accidents. Well, one really bad one and then that. But the first one was I used to skate all over Manhattan. You know, like I had a longboard, but before that, I had all these different skateboards, but I eventually settled on a longboard.
I was hoping you meant roller skates.
That would have been amazing. Oh, roller skating accident sounds even better.
Longboard,
sadder.
Not that far off.
Yeah. No, but I had this, between longboards, I bought this slalom board. It's like shaped like a fish.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And the tail, you can't, there's no kick tail really, but they're loose trucks, so you can really like lean quickly and have pretty good dexterity and turn pretty fast. Anyway, I lived in Brooklyn at the time, and I used to skate into Manhattan kind of as a workout, and I don't know why, but it was like the summer. I'm like, I'll skate into the city, then I can skate to my gigs and everything. Anyway, this is going to, I'll make this story quick. I was skating on the Brooklyn Bridge, and part of it, of course, is planks. So you're going to ride your skateboard on that part. But when you come to the down part of the bridge, where you're either coming into Brooklyn or into Manhattan, you know what I mean? Not the middle part. That's when it's paved, so you can ride a bike, you can do whatever. Well, I guess you can ride a bike on the whole thing, but for a skateboard, it's great. I got on my skateboard coming into Manhattan. I'd walked it for part of the bridge. And I remember for some reason I was wearing a bathing suit, basically. I was wearing like a kind of longer bathing suit shorts because it was hot. It was the summer. But this is the evening. And I had a t-shirt. And so my t-shirt is off. It was a different time in my life. But
it sounds like...
Are you sure this is you? Are you remembering? Did you see someone else do this?
But anyway, I had a tasty J coming out of my mouth.
The hubris. I'm wearing flip-flops. I'm on the new skateboard. T-shirt is off. And what happens is I'm going down the bridge... And I'm picking up speed on the skateboard. Anyone who's ridden a skateboard learns at some point that hills are really tricky.
Mm-hmm.
You need some space at the bottom of that hill. You need a flat. You need to be able to distribute the speed over time, over distance. And even going down the hill, when I ride on steeper hills, you know, you do turns, S-turns back and forth.
If you don't, you get the wobbles.
You get the wobbles, and that means danger. I mean, if you can't just, what do they call that? Bombing a hill, like when you go straight down, you better have some place to go when you get to the bottom. So anyway, I'm going and I'm going back and forth, and I'm starting to get a little too fast, but I'm back and forth, dragging my foot a little bit with the flip-flop. Flip-flop's not a good idea. Some kid comes by on a bike, so I have to wait for him to go by. So that's time that I'm going straight, but there were three kids on bikes.
Oh.
Now I'm in trouble. Like I'm really in trouble. I'm going so fast. And something's happened here where I'm going too fast. And I'm past this point of like putting my foot down. I'm trying, but it's like hitting the ground hard. It's like the speed's too great. And it's the flip-flop. I'm going to kind of fuck up my foot. So I don't know what to do. It's one of the few times in my adult life where I was completely suspended my thinking. And I was just like... I don't know what's going to happen.
No puzzle, no outcomes.
Yeah. It was so horrifying, man. And I was zooming past pedestrians who were coming up because there's an up and a down path. So I'm flying by people with probably the most frightened look on my face, bathing suit, no shirt, nighttime. They're like, this guy's going to kill himself.
T-shirt tethering, zooming past, flapping behind
you. Yeah, seriously. Now you get to the bottom of the Brooklyn Bridge. on the Manhattan side, and it goes into a crosswalk. There are some bushes, a couple of benches, like a little metal fence, if anybody knows this. It's like, you know what I mean? Like,
spikes. Are you saying there's no runaway skateboard ramp?
There's no gravel pit. There's no way station or runaway douchebag kind of ramp. So I realize I have to get off the board, and my best bet is to run it out. And I swear, this is one of the scariest moments of my life. Because I'm a white middle class guy. And I step off the board the fastest I can, and I flipped and fell so hard. The board disappeared. It was really scary, and I had cuts all over my back. So I fell in a way that I didn't even fall forward. The momentum was so great that I actually flipped over, and the impact was all on my shoulder and back and everything. And anyway, these ladies, people were horrified. A couple people saw me fall. It was just like a bullet coming, and this guy just full, like wiping out on skis, but just in a bathing suit on concrete. And somebody brought me my board out of the bushes. They were like, oh my God, are you okay? And my collarbone was really sore. So I got really lucky. It was really close. The bone was saying, you know, we bent as far as we could.
Yeah.
You're okay, but don't do that
just
again.
Just know that we helped you out quite a bit.
And I remember I had a double date with Leo Allen. I don't know what I was thinking, but I was going to a double date. In a bathing suit and a t-shirt and flip-flops with I was skateboarding to the date. That's
so you
not
really cared about this girl.
Oh, cut out.
It was like kind of a blind date. Like he was with the girl and she was bringing her friend. And on the way, I stopped at a CVS to get my back taken care of. And I walked in the CVS and the guy working there was like, you can't come in here without a shirt. And I turned around and just showed him like my back was all bloody and it was like dirt and everything. He's like, oh, okay, what do you need? Peroxide, please. And like, paper towels or tissues.
Now, at that point, are you trying hard to not sound like you're a tweaker? Where you're just like, I am a regular person who has been in an accident.
I'm a regular person with extremely bad judgment.
I know how this looks. I was in law school. Yeah.
You're right.
I see that you're scared. There is no bear loose in New York City.
I do remember that kind of thinking. And in New York, LA, there are two places where that happens, where you're like, look, I know there are a lot of crazy people around here.
Right.
And I look kind of messy, so it could go either way, but I'm... How can I vouch for myself?
Right.
What's the shortest distance?
I'm a square.
I was in the math team. Yeah.
I can list my allergies.
I show up to the date and I'm early, and Leo's there, and I'm like, "Can you do me a favor, man?" And he, like, just washes my back. For the date.
So sweet. God.
And then I put the t-shirt on for the date, but it was like, you know, those abrasive cuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's not deep. It's not a line.
Yeah.
It's a scrape. It's just like slicing off.
Yeah.
That's what I had. So it was. You can't. They aren't really big enough.
Just like a cheese, like a cheese knife, where you just like exactly. The top layer.
Oh, it's terrible. And then 7 days later, whatever it was, 8 days later, I was riding from like stand up New York to the comic strip.
Yeah.
Upper West to the Upper East Side, and I had my bike.
You had sore enough and skateboard.
Everyone was like, "Dude, get off your skateboard." Yeah. You're like, "You're right." I said, "I'm right." So I'm on a bike, and I do the same thing you did. I was riding, and I heard like a clicking noise in my back tire. And I turned to look, and when I turned forward again, I was going directly into a parked car.
Yeah, and there's and like, boom. It's like the amount like you would have to turn, you would end up just going over your handlebars, and so you just.
And my fist took the mirror off.
Hey.
I broke the mirror, and I left it dangling. I felt.
Did you feel strong?
I felt so, and I got to the comic strip, and my hand was all bloody. It was just like my back, like a week before, and I was like, I think I have a death wish, and I'm not sure why.
But you also seem to be unbreakable.
I was unbreakable.
Yeah, I ended up hitting the side view with my rib cage, and I couldn't even lie on my right side for a long time.
I mean, the last
that's
and
your
this
favorite
is,
side.
A year and a half ago, when did you have a broken
arm?
Yeah.
That was like, about
wrist,
a year
I don't
and
know
a half
if it was
ago.
Your wrist or arm.
No, it was my elbow. It was my right elbow.
Broke it doing his pilot for Comedy Central.
Comedy Central pilot, yeah.
Would you jump in a trash can or something? Or
Jumped over. I was going through an obstacle course and jumped through a trash can. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, oh my God, I fucking broke my elbow. But it's going to be so funny when the show gets picked up. And it's just this cute story.
But instead what happened is no show and you still had a broken elbow.
Yeah. It's still, when it gets cold,
every time it gets cold and you're like, Jonah's Arcade.
Jonah's Arcade.
You see, we inherit an interesting space for injuries. Our injury stories, I mean, I guess everyone's injury story is interesting to themselves. But on the one end of the spectrum, you have firefighters, professional athletes. You know what I mean? People who would be warriors probably in another era. You know, actual soldiers, of course. The other far end would be I guess, really obese or old people. You know, I mean, people who are not in a regular range of motion and things happen to them. But we're kind of like in between where we're not professional anything besides talkers.
Yeah.
Comedy accidents hurt 30% more than regular accidents because a comedy accident is when you're doing a comedy thing, there's a vanity reason behind it.
Absolutely.
I want people to think this is funny. I want to get attention. But in other words, it's not necessary for survival.
It's showing off.
Or anyone's survival. It's showing off. And then you get
then
hurt.
A golf
and it's
cart
like
runs
this
over you.
Poor Matt Myra.
No, you were doing that for survival.
So you
were
in a golf
cart.
So this is true. Everything's playing out true here.
Yeah.
We're finding out the kinds of injuries we have.
I want to talk to you about your experience with the comedy special.
Yes.
Because we both. When did you tape yours?
The day after yours, I think.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So we both taped ours in February.
Yeah.
And about a month before, we would sort of pass each other as we were working on the sets, and we both had that sort of like frazzled look in the eye with like stacks of notes. Like, I don't know.
It's true. Exams.
Your
like
notes
exam.
Are amazing, by
Thanks.
The way.
I'm organized.
Very organized. They're very organized, right?
Yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing in comedy. You never hear like, man, Richard Pryor was so organized.
Seinfeld is. So
Joan Rivers. But it's funny when you see Woody Allen and it's just scraps of paper.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, here's a... Here's
or Andy Kindler's got the stacks of note cards.
Yes.
Right, but we passed each other with notebooks, scraps of paper.
And I said, I really want you to come on the podcast so we can talk. I want to hear what your experience was like and just sort of hash that out a little bit because you've done specials before, though. This wasn't your first.
I did a Comedy Central Presents a long time ago, and then I did an hour for them in 2006. And then since then, you know, I did my series, but I didn't do any specials or anything.
You did a Presents when it was... You did the half hour. Comedy Central Presents is the half hour. You did a half hour when it was the choicest time to do it. It was like early in the run of the series.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a lot to rerun yet.
Yeah.
And so...
Right. So I got good exposure. And even my hour, there weren't that many hours yet on Comedy Central of original... programming as opposed to HBO's that specials that they bought or something. So that got good airtime and play. And I did Comedy Central Presents when there was still some customization, I guess you could call it, or it still had some sort of an individuality to it.
It was like a mini hour.
Right, and you were allowed to have the set a certain way because it evolved into just like, it's the same set and we just put your name and,
in
that little box there is a different name.
Cheaper.
So, yeah, I remember actually seeing you shortly after your... Comedy Central Presents, and my first question was like, how bad did you have to fight to segment it the way you did?
Yeah, that's right, and that was hard. And I've talked about that where I fought to have the drawings in it. I fought to have my friends come out on stage.
Yeah.
I fought to have the boombox and stuff, and they fought me up until the week before, and we're gonna pull my special. They were gonna kill the deal, and then I was like, that's fine. I don't want to do it if I can't do that stuff in it because I saw my friends do their specials. And I saw them edit my friend's specials. I would go to the tapings in New York. For years, they were in that same room. I saw Slovin and Allen. I saw Zax. I saw Louis Black. Tons of people. I would just go to the tapings because, you know, comics could go and you could go hang out. I was friends with everybody. And you see them kill live. And then they make them come out and do extra time if they didn't do, you know, if they didn't do the time they wanted. Even though a guy could go in with 22 minutes, have it timed perfectly, they make you go back out on stage and do...
You gotta
do another 6 minutes because our editors, you know, because they want to give themselves a luxury in the edit. It's a machine.
That happened to Lavelle Crawford, who was when Furman and I did our half hour. He was the other half hour that they were taping at the same time, and he did that. He did exactly like 22 minutes or whatever, and they made him come out and do another 10.
And they use that stuff.
I guess so. Yeah,
you know, it's just luck of the draw,
right?
But they'll take. I saw guys' closers end up as like the bump, you know, the end of the second act to go to commercial break.
Yeah.
So when I got the chance, I was like, all right, I've been doing stuff at the time at Luna Lounge in these small rooms around Manhattan.
Great. I loved Luna Lounge.
I loved Luna.
Monday night.
This was a great room on the Lower East
Ludlow
Side.
Ludlow and Houston.
On Ludlow. It's gone now. The actual building is gone. I think it's an apartment building or something.
It's right across from Pianos.
Right. It's near Pianos.
Was.
Max Fish.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that whole strip, the whole downtown.
That Monday night, that show was really fun. It really
Slipper Room near there.
I think so. Yeah.
Yep. It's around the corner.
Yeah. Anyway, that was
a great room. It encouraged experimentation, and so you could try a bit with your diary or some drawings or music or whatever. So when I got the chance to do the thing, they said, you know, you have the one-liners, just do the special. We've seen your stand-up. You can just do stand-up. I said, yes, but I really want to... I figured they rerun it. You make no money, but what you get is exposure.
Mm-hmm.
long story short, I keep saying that because I hate ending up being verbose, but my first segment I did straight stand-up, and I figured they're going to edit that. They're going to do whatever they want with it. I can't control that. Second one, have the drawings. Good luck editing that. You got continuity problems. There's a drawing on the pad that's there. You can only go to a tie to my face if you want to just remove a drawing, but that's going to be weird. And then it says the end, so I get to determine the end of my bit, and when we go to commercial, the jokes are in an order that I determine, and they can't do anything with it. And then the next one, I had a boombox. I recorded this little waltz with a piano. It's in a cassette. We come from commercial. I press play on the thing, and it's looping this thing I played.
So basically, you're playing a chess game.
I'm playing a chess game. So in this, in that segment, if you want, and I had a guitar too. Like, why? Why does the guy have a guitar and the thing? I would just strum after jokes. Because now to pull a joke out, you got to find a break in the piano thing. And the guitar, and me talking. And then the next act was like my friends come out, like the curtain opens, and people come out in costumes.
Yeah, Eugene and Sloven and Alan.
Yeah, because you can't go backwards. Like once the thing's open, the set looks different.
Yep.
So sure enough, it was exactly as I recorded it. And the first act was changed, because that's what they could change. But the rest of it was exactly as I wanted it.
I had heard other people complain about their half-hour special and be like, they cut all this stuff out that I did, and it wasn't exactly what I wanted. But... you know, I so far, I've never had anything but a great experience with them. Like, half hour was edited well. You know, I was involved in the hour special, and I thought they did a great job with that.
Yeah, so let's talk about the hours if you want. But
sure.
But the end of that whole thing was, it worked out fine, my half hour, but I had no time to rehearse, and I had one shot at bits I had never done before. My closer was this stupid thing with my friends coming out in costumes.
It's where not your like jokes I
did
come
it,
from, right?
Yeah, it's not like I did it in a theater or in any room ever. The first time ever I did it was then in front of that audience. I got one shot. Luckily, it worked well enough. It was like being on a tightrope, you know? Whereas, you know, now you did your hour. I just did this hour. I did 30 shows leading up to my hour.
Mm-hmm.
It still wasn't perfect, and I wished I did this or that different, but I kind of knew what I was doing after 30 times.
Are you too much of a perfectionist, though, or do you really feel like that?
No, I think it's somewhere in between. You know, I'm obsessed with this idea of diminishing returns. You know, in life, when you just do something for too long, then you can look back and you're like, oh, the sweet spot was there. I should have gotten out then.
Yeah.
I wish, you know, it's like Seinfeld. I mean, he seems like such a smart guy. He gets out of his series when it's still kind of going up.
Yeah.
It gets to be Seinfeld like forever.
Right.
And probably maybe it still would have been for another year, but he sensed, all right, I've reached a point, and after this is going to be diminishing returns, I'm getting out.
Well, for me, the special was that I had maybe a half hour that I really liked a lot of stuff that I was doing currently and stuff that I hadn't done on, like, you know, the John Oliver or Doug Benson or whatever the other few other stand-up shows I had done at Comedy Central. And then November, they called, late November, actually maybe early December, or it was December, they called and said, okay, we're going to give you an hour, but it shoots the beginning of February. And I was like, oh, fuck, I have to really pull together, in my mind, 45 new minutes on top of the half hour, because you really need like 75 you know, or like between 65 and 75 minutes. And so then it was a mad dash to, it was really fun and exciting, but it was a mad dash to hone the material that I had and then cobble, you know, like a bunch of new stuff together.
It's tricky because it's great to have the deadline.
Yeah.
But we've all been doing stand-up long enough where I think you can be pretty honest with yourself and say, like, you know, if I had this amount of time, I'd still be last minute and rushing, but this amount of time would be actually sensible. The amount of time you're giving me is going to be a challenge. It's going to really be hard.
Right.
Just because you need audiences.
Yeah.
I can write a million jokes in my apartment, but I still have to go find enough audiences to try the stuff out on in enough places. And there's only so many shows you can do in any given amount of time, you know?
And then you're sort of picking. And then for me, I was trying to balance and going, well, you know, I want to do some shows that I know are my audience, but then I want to step out of that and do shows where I don't know. Like, I did practice sets in, like Long Island or something, like it's just way out of town leading up to the few days leading up to the special, just to sort of make sure, because, you know.
Yeah, that's smart. I mean, when I did the Dimitri Martin person was my first hour, that was in Austin. And that was great. That was at the end of like a 28-city tour. I did two shows in one night, but even that one, similarly, they told me, hey, so we'll do an hour with you, but you have to do it in November. Because I was like, well, they said, we'll do an hour with you. I was like, great. I think by April, I'll be good.
Right.
And they said, no, you have to do it in November. I was thinking, yikes. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull it off. That's a lot less time to get this thing together.
Yeah.
And then we got to Austin. It was two shows in one night. We got there, and it turns out the LA crew and the Texas crew weren't quite getting along. And then the people at the theater had a play in there, and they wouldn't allow us to get in there before the people from the play got to break down all their stuff. So there was like this day that we thought we had that was removed from the schedule.
Ugh.
It was a complete nightmare.
And of course, you sound like a douchebag when you call me and you go, I'm taping a TV show. And they're like, we don't give a shit.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Totally. And it's like, no, Tears of a Clown. Like, I don't know if that's the right usage of that term. But I'm a clown and I was upset. So yeah.
It's the right song.
Yeah. No, but it was like, it was a disaster. And I remember the lighting guy and the sound guy were fighting. The audience was in the lobby and they'd already been held for like 15 or 20 minutes on the first show because that was going to affect the second show. They were fighting a shouting match. And I was on the side of the stage thinking, I'm dead. This is crazy. First taping of that hour, I used hardly any of it. It was a disaster. The lighting changed, like all these things happened.
Oh.
And I remember between shows, I was yelling. I've done this at least three times in my career where I'm like, talking to my agent, and I'm like in the alley behind the theater. I'm like, I'm going to buy it back. We're not doing this. I'm not airing this. I have this. I don't know where I started to think that you can buy things back.
We're going to get the master tapes. Don't worry.
Whatever they paid me, I'll double it.
It's just this idea, like money I don't have. I'm like, I'm buying it back. I don't want it out there. I don't want my name on this. Like, I'm buying it back. And he's like, you're not buying it back. You can't buy it back.
Doesn't work that way.
Then the second taping went better for that one. And like, that was the bulk of my special. For this one, I didn't want to do it in New York. I love New York. But after touring all over, you go to these other cities and people are excited that you're there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like an event. Yeah. If you do your thing in Denver or something.
It is, but I love the vibe of New York audiences is really great. And it's been particularly great with stuff that I've taped there stand-up wise. I don't know. I think audiences, they're energetic, they get it, they understand, they give back, which is sort of, you know, is what you need with an audience, to give a little bit.
Yeah.
But
you know, you've been from LA for a while though.
Yes. Long time.
So if it might be similar, even though they're very different cities, like for me, I spent 14 years in New York.
Got it.
So I did so many spots around there. I love New York. That's my favorite place to do stand up. But when I'm taping something, I'm just like, yikes. I feel like they're like, oh yeah, Dimitri, he's always around. So it's like, I lose some of the juice, even though I love those crowds. And I don't think there's a better place as an American comedian to build up your act.
Than New York.
Than New York.
Yeah, I always tell people, like, if they're near a hub city like Chicago or San Francisco or Austin or like cities with good little comedy hubs, and like learn there, then go to New York.
Yeah.
Then you can go to LA.
Yeah.
Once you've sort of honed your act, if you want to go into the entertainment business rather than just do stand up, go to LA. If you want to just do stand up, tour the country, you know?
Right. New York is great for making stuff. LA is great for selling stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can bounce back and forth between the two, it seems like you could time it right. Well, you can go to New York, make some new stuff, come back, try to sell it.
Did you feel, was your experience good for this special?
Yes, it was. My only gripe, and you're right, it's like being a perfectionist or just looking at the negative, was I remembered some of the road shows, and Austin was great. But I asked them, I said, I want to do my special in Austin. And they said, you did your last one there, like, change it up. It was 6 years ago. It doesn't matter. The crowds were great, even with my half-ass, totally like ham-fisted special. It was still great in Austin. And so I did a warm-up show in New York on Wednesday before the gig in that room.
Mm-hmm.
And the crowd was just like too cool for school. And like jokes that were doing really well in like almost every other city, some of them were just like, meh. And I thought, this sucks. I'm gonna have a shitty special. And so I freaked out. Couldn't do anything about it.
So did you get on the phone in the alley and buy it back?
I flew to Austin. I went to that alley.
Yeah.
I told my agent, get down here.
You are spending a lot of money.
I don't do it right. You know, but I'm a perfectionist. And I knew that that's where I freaked out. That alley in Austin.
Oh, you went to Buyback Alley.
I went to Buyback Alley. You know that
place. Buy back everything that you regret.
I think it worked out just fine. And it was good. And I did have a good experience. And Comedy Central was, they treat me very politely. And no, there were no crazy notes. I don't know about for you, but it was fun.
No,
you know?
I've had, honestly, every experience I've had working with them, I've luckily, it's been a really great experience, and they've been really cool about stuff and they don't hassle me and they're nice to me. Like it genuinely, as much as I thought I would flip out about this special, I never really had a flip out moment about it. Like when I first found out I was going to do it, I had a couple of flip out days of like, yeah, I'm not ready. This is my special. It's got to be perfect.
Right.
And then something in me just said, you know what? Just fucking do it. Just get it. Yeah. Just do your head down. Do it and don't make it a. I didn't want my experience of the first special to be, oh, I was a wreck. Oh my God, it was a. And so I didn't, and it was really fun. Yeah. It was really fun.
It's cool. You know, after going overseas, the first time I ever got to go over there, 2003, to really do shows in Scotland, meeting so many of the comedians over there, many people I'd never heard of, but a lot of whom had hours.
That's where you, oh my God, so you went to Edinburgh Festival, and then I saw you right after that at Bumbershoot, and that's when you brought these young Kiwi friends of yours named Brett and Jermaine,
right,
and put them on the Bumbershoot Festival. You gave them your stage time.
Yeah. And you guys should come if you're going to be in America.
And they crushed, and then Flight of the Conchords.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. We hung out. I had met those guys and had so much fun.
So Edinburgh fun for you?
I loved it. I did it 4 times. But it taught me a lot about expectations. Because they have that festival every year, and there aren't as many TV opportunities, and there aren't television specials the way you have. There's no Fallon or Conan, really. You know, there's Jonathan Ross, but it's not the same. They don't have the same system to go through. So people gear up every year for that festival, and they'll do 30 shows in a month. They'll do 30 hour-long performances of a show that they wrote. And if they want to come back the next year, then they have a new hour that they do 30 times at that festival the next summer. So they just, festival's over, they start working on next year's show. So the expectation just dictates a much more prolific crop of comedians than what we have here. And of course, Americans could be as prolific, but we don't have the same structure.
So
Louis does it.
Yeah,
like a
Louis
few guys
it.
Do it. But over there, Louis's not an anomaly. They all do it.
Mm-hmm. There, they're doing an hour. Everywhere here, they're trying to get 5 clean minutes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah,
that's exactly. True. You said it succinctly. I mean, that was an interesting thing to me. So it just changed the way I understood building up my act.
Yeah.
You know, to try to be on that clock, which I can't quite do because I'm trying to write other things and stuff. But I thought it was interesting that you can do an hour every year if you have to.
Yeah. So with, you know, I always wanted to be able to write like 2-line jokes because it just, they're fun and they're quick and they, you know, you can catch, you can kind of broadside people with them, and I don't write them well. Like my stuff just drags out. And then as the more I was into it, the more I became afraid of 2-line jokes because I go, oh, but then they sort of, there's sort of like a 50-50 chance, you know, that people are going to get it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's not the right number, but it's basically that whole joke sinks or swims based on the turn that you can put on
it. It's hard to hide. It's hard to hide with if you're just doing straight jokes, there's a very objective moment where you're like saying, I always say it's like telling one-liners is like, it's like asking a girl out on a date like a bunch of times in a row. There's a definitive spot where you're asking her out. We're not friends. Like, I like you.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like that kind of a trust fall. Whereas I mean, they're all difficult in different ways, right? If you do longer bits, it just has to earn its keep.
Right.
And at least with the short jokes, they're just like little Skittles. You're just popping one after the other. And like, I didn't like that flavor. What about this one? So they're kind of easy come, easy go. But to headline, you need a lot of them.
But did you ever want to be, was there ever any sense of, you know, maybe I want to be maybe I want to be a Louis or a Marin style of comic where I just bear everything on stage? Or,
you know, in Edinburgh, the first year, that wasn't a one-liner show. That was a personal show that ended up on the internet, and it's not a good recording of it, but I talked about palindromes and all this personal stuff. Again, I'm not Louis or Richard Pryor or Marin. I was on the math team, you know, but it was very honest. Like, I just talk about myself. My second show I did in Edinburgh was about my marriage and divorce when I was young. It was about falling in love with this girl in high school. It was super personal, long stories. And then the third show was also personal. These are shows I didn't do here. I did them at UCB in New York 5 times ever. And then I took them overseas, did them at those festivals, and that was it. Because it was interesting. They didn't know me as a one-liner comic over there. I was a storytelling, you know, so it was cool that the stuff worked and I can do that. But what I found was, when you do really personal stuff, the show is you. Mm-hmm. Even though one-liners are me too. But the line between me and the content is so thin, almost invisible, often gone, that if I do it too many times, not only do I get sick of the show and hate the show, I hate myself.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because the show is me. I'm just using up, I'm cannibalizing my personal, private experience to sell it to people. So what I've done is I've already taken what's a very tenuous, tiny line between me and the content as a comedian. We sell ourselves. Strippers maybe are the only people who sell more of themselves than we do, in a sense. You know what I mean? A singer-songwriter, yes, but often it's veiled.
Right.
There's like some distance between you and the content. A novelist wrote a book. You know, you have a band, you sell the band.
So you're basically on stage showing your emotional tits.
Yeah, which of course is the most captivating, best stuff. It's Richard Pryor is Richard Pryor because he's doing that.
Right.
So I love that and I aspire to it. I just haven't found a way to do it that doesn't make me end up hating myself and doing it over and over again. But whereas jokes, I love the puzzle of it.
Of course.
You know what I mean? There's a game to it that is still really personal. There's something very vulnerable about being like we were talking about, like, that's the punchline. Like, I think this is funny. That's like trying to sing on key. It's like, I'm singing right now. This is it. I'm going for it. You know?
But the type of stuff that you do does inform a lot about how you problem solve. It informs a lot about how you see things, because there's always sort of a backdoor into something, like, you know, peeing into the pool is different than peeing in the pool is different than peeing into the pool.
I think so. And as I've gotten older, like I have migrated more towards longer bits. But it's interesting to hear you say the reciprocal. And Jonah, I don't know about for you, but if it's like, geez, I thought of this one-liner and
I have nowhere to put them.
That's what happens. They end up being these little sore thumbs. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sometimes I'll have them around if a longer bit doesn't do well. I'll say a one-liner just to get them back up.
It's a parachute.
Exactly.
Or I find that sometimes I'm trying to reverse engineer them into longer bits.
That's interesting.
So that they become a punch of a longer bit rather than just, you know, like floating out there and disconnected to anything.
Yeah.
But I do like the sorbet idea of like, here's a little, intermission before the next chunk.
I just dump them on Twitter.
Yeah,
but then the thing is, I put them on Twitter, but then that goes away. The feed goes away.
But at least I got the idea out there. And if people respond to that, it's probably, what?
You know, it's like, I think the great luxury we have doing comedy is that you get this kind of unedited opportunity with a live audience, of course, to just express yourself. You can try anything. I could be, starting tomorrow, just do really personal, long stories. And I have that prerogative. The crowd might not like it, but no one's stopping me. Right. You know what I mean? It's up to me. I do know that my favorite performers, I think I realized this last year or the year before. For me, it's really helpful if I can articulate something in words. Probably it's why I do one-liners.
Yeah.
It's almost like I need one-liners for myself to remind me about my principles, like what I believe, what I understand. It sounds stupid, but it really does help me. In diagrams, too. I don't know, whatever. But I remember thinking that my favorite performers, probably from any era, and not just in comedy, but actors and I guess musicians too, but certainly comedians, they have this great almost paradox where they're equal parts like commanding and vulnerable at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Too much of either, I don't like. If it's invulnerable and just too confident and commanding, it's like, I don't care. It's inhuman. I'm not connected to that person. And if it's too vulnerable, it's like, please like me. It's cloying. It's syrupy, it's gross and too sentimental.
Yeah.
It's weak. It's too porous, you know?
Yeah.
But the right balance, and I keep mentioning Richard Pryor because not too long ago I saw one of his amazing specials and you're like, that's awesome. You're never in doubt about his command of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also like, you know, he's really giving you something, you know? Yeah. You know, like those two together I think are authenticity. Like that's like, you can't fake that. Like,
yeah, well, it's even the way he started that one special, I think, Live Sunset Strip, he's like, hello, hope I'm funny.
Yeah.
Just like, that's very, it's like, it,
it's
that's
amazing.
How he starts the show. And confidently, he says that, I hope this is going to be okay.
Sometimes I think about Bernie Mac. If you see Bernie Mac in the early days on the Def Jam specials and stuff, when he's like, I ain't scared of you motherfuckers, like, God, that's such a smart idea. That's so true. Like, I think a comedian can relate to that.
You can't fake that, though.
You can't fake that. That's the thing, yeah.
You can't fake that, and that's experience. But, you know, I found when I do start to... And I think, you know, I think the Richard Pryors and the Louis of the world make people think, oh, it's just as easy as getting up and telling personal story. But it's a very hard thing to do because, you know, when you start telling a really personal story on stage... you have to figure out what's fucking funny about it, because otherwise people just go, oh, like they just feel bad.
I call it the who gives a shit test. And like, that's my problem with stories, is that everyone has memoirs and it's so anecdotal and all this stuff, but who gives a shit? You have to be really good. It's deceptive. You have to be like, Louis figured it out.
Yeah.
Because I give a shit. If he tells a good story and there's some sort of a universal in it, you know, it's authentic.
It took a long time, though, because if you watch...
Yeah.
And it really happened, I think it happened, you know, around the time his kids were born.
Yeah.
Because before that, he was a fucking amazing concept and joke writer, and he would write these really incredible bits about going to hell and come here, suck my dick. Oh, you suck that guy's dick? He doesn't work here. Yeah. Oh, I thought you know, like these really great sort of philosophical...
The racist guy that grew up on a farm. It's like, well, what, the animals racist? You know, all that stuff.
And then all of a sudden it's, you know, he has this amazing skill set. He knows, you know, he figured out where comedy is, and it's very authentic.
I think it's like finding,
and then it's personal, and then it has substance.
Yeah, and I think it's just one of those things that he found the weird root in his brain. Like, you know, I pour the concept in this one, and it just filters through, and it comes out of my mouth funny.
Because you think about, well, and a lot, they become, at a certain point, you do comedy so much that hopefully the goal is you become kind of a machine in the way that anything that you consume is going to come out like a hay baler. It doesn't even really, you don't have to sit down and go.
But what's also interesting is that we're so dependent. It's such a dialogue. There's such a dialectic, our job. Like, it's not, you don't just, I can't think of other good examples, counterexamples, but I do know that, like, if I were a musician, I could theoretically practice, and just play in my room. I could get a guitar when I was 10 years old, listen to Hendrix and the Beatles and everybody, and get amazing. And then emerge at, like, age 30. With, like, you know, 50 unbelievable songs.
But I still think, even as a musician, you have to figure out how to connect to an audience,
no matter how
technically good you are. And I think with stand-up, it's definitely a dialogue. Yeah. The audience is a unified body, and you are having a one-on-one conversation with them. So I think about it like, well, if I'm having a phone conversation with someone, and they just make a lot of jokes and they're funny, but I don't really get any substance out of it. Do I walk away going, oh yeah, that guy was funny, you know? But I don't know if I necessarily feel like I have to talk to that person all the time, because there wasn't really any substance. So,
but
I,
you know what it is? The dialogue is interesting, because it's not just between you and the audience in the room. And of course, there's you and yourself, like you were saying, finding the root in your head or whatever. There's the larger audience. It's just where comedy happens to be at.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Louis is a great example, because he's been well respected by so many comedians for a long time, and he's been funny in different ways. But there's almost an interesting confluence, I think, for Louis, where he was doing more absurd stuff that I think was authentic, and that was him at that point. And when you hear him talking about working at Conan and eating tons of ice cream until he like kind of passed out, you know, that's his life. But there's that, and then there's the economy goes a certain way, the country goes a certain way, media goes a certain way, and then Louis also grows in a certain direction, talks about more personal stuff at a time. It's darker.
Yeah.
At a time when I think the world got a little darker. You know what I mean? Like, there's something that's out of your control, too, I think, that happens, where there's like a kind of
flashpoint.
There's a flashpoint. There's like a synergy, and like it like really hit
all of the elements, they definitely do come together. Like, you know, as how much of it are sort of accidental qualities, in the sense of, you know, let's say if Louis were like a super handsome, chiseled guy, would the material play as well? Right. Or does it, part of it work because, you know, here's this guy who sort of looks blue collar-y, you know, is kind of bald, doughy guy. And then he comes out with these really brilliant philosophical angles on very simple concepts that all people think, that these really intelligent, it's obviously an incredibly smart guy. You know, is part of that, does part of that disarm the audience? Does that kind of, because one thing he's masterful at is saying some of the worst things that people could say on stage and get away, and you still are on his side.
Yeah. I always say that, like, you know, you can be funny or you can be cool. Pick one. Because I think as a comedian, like, you want to be cool sometimes, or like a rock star, but it's hard. I think it's hard to really be funny if you're worried about that kind of a thing.
Of course, because you're too guarded.
You're too guarded. Yeah, yeah. Like, right, coolness, there's an aloofness just built into it. And I remember Slovin and Allen used to say something like, muscles and suntans aren't funny. Or something like that. But I was like, you know, I think that's kind of true. I think that's, you know, I'm sure there are exceptions to every rule that you come up with. But generally, they're interesting signposts that kind of help you understand it a little bit.
Yeah. I think The Rock is pretty funny.
The Rock is very funny.
I don't know if he would do stand up though. He's muscles in
his last hour wasn't that good though.
Nah.
Oh my god!
You mean the last hour of Race to Witch Mountain too?
No, I mean when he's
he bought it back. Did you? How did you?
He could buy it back. He could actually buy it back.
He was in the wrong alley.
Buy it back.
He was in barbecue alley.
But it is interesting though to, and I, you know, I've talked about this before with these guys and probably on this podcast, but now starting the new hour and just being able to really ask a question which I didn't really ask before with the first hour, which is, what do I want to say?
Yeah.
Which is a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Yeah. I can totally relate to what you're saying, because I think as my mood changes, just as a human being, of course, everybody in my audience or the large audience, they're kind of subject to that rise and fall. Do you know what I mean? It's like Twitter's a perfect example. We were talking about this last night at Meltdown. Sarah was there and Doug Benson. And saying, do you guys sometimes just don't feel like tweeting something that's supposed to be funny, but just like just an idea, or just trying to, you just feel something and you just kind of want to,
yeah, right, it just comes out. Yeah.
And then the responses you get, although I stopped looking at my at replies a long time ago because it never felt better after that. But
Beyonce.
Oh, you're so smart.
I am Beyonce.
But it would be like, that's not funny. You're falling off. You're not funny anymore. You suck. You fucking suck. Not funny. How'd you have a show? You know, and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, I know it's not funny. It actually wasn't supposed to be funny. I am a human. Like, it's not just always joke.
No, but but I think the way people see you is that, you know,
that's my service for them.
That's your service for them. And, you know, because people have to categorize more in their brains than have ever had to in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
And I don't think I don't think we're evolved to handle the amount of information that we have to sort through.
I totally agree.
And so people, I think as a default, just they have to see everything very one-dimensionally because that's the only way they can categorize everything in their brain. You're that guy to them.
That's right.
You're not a person. You're just a one-dimensional output device.
Right.
And so if you step outside the definition of what they have to be able to categorize in your mind, that's just like, you know, their brain says, oh, that's a glitch in the Matrix. I better point that out.
That's partly why I called my special person. That last one, it was like Dimitri Martin person. It was just like, you know, I'm just a person. Like, I tell jokes because a human being, which of course I am, but I thought very similarly to what you're saying.
Yeah.
Just this, I always say that in showbiz, like, you will be put into a box. Like, that's how it works. We are things that we're selling. So the trick is when you're anonymous, when nobody knows who you are, you just have to make the biggest, weirdest shape box possible. So when they put you in it, at least you can move around in there.
Yeah.
Like if you're in a rush, I know guys, you guys know these guys and women who they start and they're like, they want to do Letterman, they want to, whatever, they want to get on TV, like get me out there, I want to be famous. And I'm always like, just nobody knows who you are. Like you have so much freedom.
Yeah. Just experiment,
like do anything. And I guess you can always do that if you're really courageous. You could be Bob Dylan and just be like, fuck everybody, I'm going electric. You can do that.
Yeah.
But hopefully when you do that, you still get to eat and make money along the way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it is. I definitely think the downside for the famous comics is that, first of all, people come to the show with a tremendous amount of expectation.
Right.
And they're just not given a lot of leeway to try stuff out.
Right. Like if you're Chris Rock or Seinfeld, I mean, those guys are awesome and they're going to draw.
Yeah.
But they probably still want to grow as artists and try different stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
And
because if you're not grown as an artist, like, are you still an artist?
Right.
Oh, philosophical. This is calling it back.
You sounded depressed saying it as much as we were hearing it.
Mm. I don't know. I think it's interesting. Right, it's one of the great luxuries and pleasures of getting to do comedy is that it's a very thoughtful journey.
Mm-hmm.
It can be. You know, you can be a clown and I guess just do really stupid stuff. And if you're lucky, that hits and you get the money. But
did you feel competition with other one-line joke comics? Because there was a period where I feel like there was a mini explosion all around the same time. One like, you know,
it was like 2001.
It was around 2001.
Well,
because you have Zach, you have Morgan Murphy, you have Dan Mintz, you have BJ Novak.
Yeah. Everyone was doing. I was even. That's when I started, and that's what I was trying to do one liners.
I tried and failed.
I was the worst.
Couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I started in 1997, and I was a huge Stephen Wright fan. I watched a lot of comedy on TV in the 80s, and I thought I was going to be a lawyer, so I never thought I was going to be a comedian. But I related to what Stephen Wright was doing because it's such a nerdy reason, but I love doing like puzzle books and stuff. and I liked doodling and all this. So like there was something like aesthetically actually very pleasing that's like felt like it was fulfilling something in me when I learned how to write jokes. My first set ever was 12 jokes. And they were like, I remember writing S:P: when I would write a joke. I would write like a puzzle, like the setup ends at this word and the punchline begins
with this word. That's
fascinating. Like my way in was very like technical.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started, understandably so, people said, you're Stephen Wright. And I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I'm influenced by him because that he was so different than everybody else. Mm-hmm. Then I discovered Woody Allen, way back to Henny Youngman, and you realize, okay, it is a form. It's just that in each era, there weren't that many people doing it. In the 80s, you do have Emo Phillips. You do have Brian Kiley's been around quite a while. He's a Conan writer, and he's a one-liner. Mm-hmm. So there are guys, but in terms of that mass popularity, Stephen Wright was kind of the guy, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I started, everybody was like, you're Stephen Wright. Then a few years in, Mitch Hedberg, who I'd never heard of. Of course, Mitch became Mitch Hedberg.
Mm-hmm.
So people start telling me, you're like Mitch, you're Mitch, you're Mitch. And I'm like, who's Mitch? So then I see Mitch. He was in New York at the comic strip. I went, my friend's like, come up and you'll see this guy. And so I go to the comic strip. This is in the 90s or maybe 2000. And I watch Mitch and I'm like, yeah, okay, I see. You know, I'm similar. I was like, I'm kind of a nerd. I mean, he's like a stoner guy. You know, you can draw distinctions immediately. To the larger world, what's the difference between me, Zach, Mitch? Name him. He's a white guy. Doesn't have a conventional haircut. The jokes aren't that long.
But
you know
if,
I mean?
You really, if you really uncover the layers, you see this. It's a difference. But I guess it's like saying like, well, that one band has a guitar player. Well, that band has a guitar player. Well, they must be the same.
Well, you know
band.
What it is? It's just it again comes back to authenticity.
Yeah.
Like if I don't think in one-liners all the time, how long can I fake the funk for? If I'm really ripping someone off, then it's gonna come out because you can't do it for that long.
Did you ever meet Stephen Wright?
Yeah. He was super nice. I've met him a couple times. I have a Stephen Wright story I can tell you guys if
please.
You have the time here. He is like pretty close to my all-time favorite. When I was a kid, Bill Cosby, Stephen Wright, you know, I love Peter Sellers, but there's just a few comedy giants for anybody, you know, who was in comedy. So I got booked to do, one time I met him at Conan when I was a writer and one of the writers brought me down who knew him. He was a guest on the show. This is when Conan was in New York, like in 2003, I guess this was. And I said, oh, Stephen, hey, I'm a comedian and I'm a fan and I'm influenced by you, but I think I'm kind of figuring out my own thing. He's like, you're the guy with the drawings, right? I said, yeah. He's like, those are hilarious.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, wow, thanks so much. I didn't realize you knew my stuff. He goes, yeah. He goes, I don't know about for you. He goes, but when I'm writing jokes, I mean, when I come up with new jokes, each one's only like 20 seconds long. So it takes me a long time to build up my act, you know? I said, yeah. And he's like, and it's only like one in every, like, you know, four or five. That's like funny, I guess, that he comes up with. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I walk away and I'm thinking like, I have to come up with like 20 jokes probably to get a good one. And I'm like, this guy's five times funnier than I am. Mathematically.
Jeez.
But anyway, so years later, I got booked on a benefit in Toronto. My agent called me and said, hey, it's just this benefit for this great thing. It's in this theater and you're going to be the headliner. Do you want to do it? And it paid some money. I said, yeah, yeah, that'd be great. Sounds awesome. I like Toronto crowds. I don't know if...
I love Toronto.
Right. So we just went for the first time.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Fantastic. They're great. So I was like, absolutely. And then that was a few months out. And then a month later or something, or pretty close to the gig, my agent calls me back and he says, hey, I just want to let you know they just added Stephen Wright to the show. They just booked Stephen Wright on the show too. And I was like, am I still doing it? I said, yeah, yeah. There's a few comics, but Stephen Wright's going to
be one. This was just a couple years ago.
Yeah, a couple years ago.
I was at that festival. That was just for Laughs Toronto.
Was it around then? Yeah.
It was around summertime.
Okay, yeah. It might have been around then. Yeah. So I said, yeah, okay. I guess, so he's gonna close out the show then, right? Because he said, no, he's going to be at the end of the first half. There's a break. And I was like, that's not appropriate. I'm not comfortable with that. I think Stephen Wright should close out the show. Well, Stephen Wright's such a gentleman. He's such a laid-back guy. He genuinely doesn't care. And he says, I'll talk to him, but I don't think he cares. And he says, he doesn't care, whatever you want. I was like, I think he should close the show if he's comfortable with that. I think he's Stephen Wright, and I'm who I am, and it's obviously. He's like, okay, yeah, sure. So he'll close the show. You'll close the first half. Great. We go to the show, and I do my thing, and it's totally fine. It goes great, and then Stephen Wright closes the show. Awesome. He's got amazing new jokes. I'm enjoying just watching the show. Next day, my next stop is Boston, so I go to the airport the next day, and I get on the plane. It's a small plane. And of course, Stephen Wright lives in Boston, and I'm not thinking. So I'm on the plane, and I see Stephen Wright get on the plane. I talked to him for a couple minutes after the show that night, the night before, and he was totally gracious and nice, and it was great. Like, oh, cool. Like, he remembered me. It was cool.
Oh, nice.
So the next day, I'm on the plane, and I see Stephen Wright get on the plane. He's coming down the aisle, and I see him. He's just such a subtle presence. But I'm in my seat, and there's an empty seat across the aisle from me, and I see him stop and look at his ticket and look at me, and just I'm just sensing the smallest, like, facial change of, like, shit. I gotta sit across from this young guy. This guy who's, like, kind of influenced, but this is, you know, I'm feeling for the guy. Just having been on the other side of it, like, at a college or something where you're like, just please leave me alone. Like, it's totally, just please. And so I just nod to him, and I'm thinking, I'm gonna leave the guy alone. I'm not gonna bother him. It's fine. He's like, hey. He sits down, and then so we just fly, take off. And, like, halfway through the flight, I'm thinking, I'm not going to bother him. If we don't talk, that's totally fine. I'm not going to bother him. But he initiates the conversation. He's like, so do you like flying? He starts doing crowd work. So he's being so cool and, like, kind of talking to me. You know, so we're talking and saying, you know, I don't like it, but I've flown more than I ever thought I would in my life. I'm sure you guys have a similar experience.
Yep.
It's like, this is the job, you know? So I learned to deal with it. And he's like, yeah. I was like, did you ever go to Australia? He said, yeah, yeah. I said, that sucked, huh? He's like, yeah, you know what? That flight was so long that I almost kind of forgot that I was... It was just... he's saying funny stuff. That's just like, that's how his mind works. So we land, and he's like, you going to baggage claim? I said, yeah. He's like, I'll see you there. All right. So he leaves. And then I get off the plane, and I'm heading to baggage claim. And then there's an escalator that goes down to baggage claim. And I see Stephen Wright's disappearing down the escalator. And at the top of the escalator, there's a guy with a sign that says my name on it. It's a driver taking me to this, you know, hotel for my gig. He's like, do you have any bags? And I don't. I just have carry-on. I said, no. He's like, all right, the car's just out here. And so I have this moment of like, oh, so we're not going to go through baggage claim. I told him I was going to go through baggage claim, but I guess I'll avoid that. Should I go down there and say goodbye to him, not have a bag, and then just go right back up? You know, I'm overthinking it.
Of course.
This is stupid, you know. So I figure, let me leave the guy alone. I take off. And so I don't go through baggage claim. And then like 15, 20 minutes later, I'm in the car. I'm almost at my hotel. The driver answers his phone. He's like, all right. He hands me the phone in the back seat. He says, the other driver's passenger wants to talk to you. Hello? Stephen Wright. I thought you said you were going to baggage claim.
Oh, shit.
Is that amazing?
Oh, my God.
It was the best. It's a long story, but it was like, for me, it was just totally thrilling. He's like, I'm living a Stephen Wright joke.
I mean, which is the ultimate gift.
The ultimate gift.
Being influenced by someone and then having them pull you into their world in that way.
It totally is. I was just totally flattered and thrilled by the whole thing. And I said, oh, man, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't know I was, but I didn't know it was downstairs, and so I just figured I'd leave you alone. He's like, I just want to say it was great working with you, and you know, maybe I'll see you again, because I'd seen him in Santa Monica on the street once. He's like, we've seen each other in weird places.
Yeah,
maybe I'll see you in some city someday. So yeah, next time you're in California, if you ever want to ride or something, you know, I'll drive you somewhere. It's pretty cool. He was awesome. I mean, that guy's a class act. He's brilliant, dude. Yeah. I mean, he's Stephen Wright.
I met him once, and I was in Vegas. I'd been up all night, and I walked past him in the hotel lobby, and I was like, oh, fuck. And I was wearing this, like, dumb hat and these sunglasses.
Because
I'd been up all night. I was in the right space. I took them off. I threw them on the ground and, like cleaned myself up a bit. Like, and I went over to him. I was like, no, Mr. Wright. He was like, yeah. And I was like, my name's Joe. I'm a comic. I'm a really, really big fan of yours. I grew up watching. He's like, oh, cool. What are you doing in Vegas? And then and then we ended up talking for about 45 minutes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and he's like, I was like, well, I'll see you around, I guess. I didn't know how to leave, and I started walking away. He's like, hey, Jonah. And like, I turn around, and he just offered me, he's like, how many friends you got with you? And I was like, oh, there's like five of us. He's like, well, give me your name, I'll write it
That's
down.
Amazing.
And then we all got into his show that night.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's a nice story. I had to interview him once I wrote a piece for Wired about the joke writing process.
Wow.
And so I interviewed him and Bob Newhart couple of really great people. And but my phone conversation with Stephen Wright was so it was very off-putting, in the sense that I'm very bad at letting moments breathe. I always feel like I have to put noise in here. And
me too.
He would I would ask a question.
No, I'm serious though. I know I'm a silence filler, man. I'm just like you.
And so I would ask him a question, and there would be a long pause to the point where it almost felt like, all right, he's either hung up or he doesn't like, you know, I'm building this whole story.
Was there a lot of like, hello?
Yeah. And then so just as I'm about to go, you don't have to answer then, and then he would answer.
Wow.
But there were so many, it was... He definitely forced me to communicate in his rhythm, which was very hard because his rhythm is totally different than mine. But he was a fascinating guy to talk to just about his joke writing.
Yeah, he
process.
Was talking about how he's like, yeah, I guess I've influenced a lot of guys, but I don't see it. You know, I like what other people are doing. And then he talked about how it's so weird because he's like, I continually do comedy. I do shows all around the country. But like because people don't see me on TV, they think I'm not doing comedy anymore.
Yeah.
Which is a weird idea. He's
I used to see him around Boston all the time. Yeah. He was always super...
Back when Boston had a comedy scene.
Yeah.
And it's cool because, you know, he always mentions George Carlin as an influence. Like, he really likes George Carlin.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting. You can't escape yourself, even if he was ever trying to do Carlin. He's Stephen Wright. That's the way he talks in conversations, and like that's how it works, you know?
Yeah.
That's how you get to stick around, is like you can't escape yourself. If you try to, you lose.
He really was one of those guys. I mean, like, I watched every comedy special in the 80s, and he was definitely one of those guys that if I heard he was in the lineup for something, it was like, oh, I'm going to keep watching this until I see him, because it was just such... I mean, even Emo does do... Like, he sort of broadsides you with angles that you don't see coming, but a lot of them are stories that turn really hard.
Twist around.
It's not the, you know...
That's true.
I did this, and then so this weird thing happened. I did this, and this other weird thing. Like, he's definitely...
Yeah.
There is a mechanism that's similar, but Emo just kind of pulls you more into these longer pieces.
It's so amazing, too. But he'll have, like, a whole story about, like going on a date with a girl, but, like, every other line is just a crazy, like, punchline, laugh line. It's incredible.
You mean Steven or Emo?
Emo.
Yeah.
But it just kind of keeps on twisting to, you know, different areas.
I always sort of wanted that to... I was very envious of the guys who were weird characters on stage, because it sort of seemed like... Once you build that as your character, you can get away with a lot because no matter what you say, people are like, that's coming out of that weird character, so that must be really funny. Like, just being a dude kind of sucks.
The trick is if you want to work in other stuff.
That's true. Yeah.
That is the trick.
And not just be that guy.
Because Bobcat's talking
about that. Bobcat, of course, of not having to be Bobcat and everything.
Because it's weird. It's like a rocket booster that shoots you ahead.
Right.
And then... You're like run out of fuel.
So much faster.
The candle that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And you have burned so very, very bright.
Lady Philosopher.
What was that?
No, that's from Blade Runner. It's the Terrell Corporation. Right before Rutger Hauer puts his fingers in his eyeballs. Spoiler alert.
What?
If you haven't seen Blade Runner by now, you're probably not going to see Blade Runner.
There's an 11-year-old going, I was going to watch it tonight.
You spoiled it for
me.
Well, we're at about an hour, and this was... is there anything you have coming up that you want to talk about? Or?
Yeah, sure. I'll talk about... people just switched off.
he was going to say lunch. I'm pretty sure he was going to talk about lunch.
No, so I did an album along with that special, but I recorded it separately. So I did an album in a comedy club in Minneapolis at Acme.
Acme's a great club.
Great, yeah. So that I have that out there now. It's the same title, Dimitri Martin Stand-Up Comedian. But, you know, my special, I had some drawings, and I did this thing with flyers. So those are visual bits.
Sure.
So, and the special that airs is only 40 minutes about.
Mm-hmm.
So I got about an hour-long album that's like 20 minutes of different stuff that I worked really hard on, so I'm trying to get people to at least download it or something. And then I got a book of drawings coming out in the spring.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I remember that. I remember you telling me about that.
It's taking me a while. It was supposed to come out this fall and I missed my deadline. And it's just taken so long to actually do the drawings because I got like a dipping pen and ink.
Oh.
I'm trying to learn how to really do ink drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And I did more than I was going to do for the book, so I think it'll be a better book. It'll be thicker. But it's called Point Your Face at This. And I think it's on pre-sale before Christmas.
Now, Dimitri, because the thicker book doesn't always mean it's better.
No, I know. But this one is like, I made sure that...
It's quality thickness.
I met this other one-line comic who's doing a book of drawings, but with a quill.
Oh, shit. Is it the ghost of Mitch Hedberg? It's Henny Youngman.
Yeah, yeah.
I am a spectral being. I can pass my hand through your corporeal body. Here I go. Boo. Why do ghosts say boo? I don't know. It just feels like...
That's a good impression.
What are they disapproving of?
So whenever I am doing poorly at a show, I ask myself, is this room haunted?
Nice. I think you guys just wrote a good bit.
I think I just wrote a good bit for Mitch Hedberg. Or Mitch Dedberg, who is zombie Mitch Hedberg.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dimitri. I hope we had a good time.
Thanks for being on the very last Nerdist podcast.
What are you talking about?
It's kind of cool because you guys are obviously not only comedians but comedy fans, which is nice. Some people are comedians and they're also kind of cranks about the whole
thing. No. Yeah. I couldn't. I don't know. You know, some people who just use comedy as a vehicle, I don't get it. Yeah. Like, I can never imagine a time where I won't want to do stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, I made it to a certain point that I thought I wanted to get to. I don't need to do that shit anymore.
Also, you know, one of the funnest parts about when you're starting out doing comedy, you know, I always tell comics that, you know, or looking guys that want to start doing comedy or want advice, I tell them, well, you know, half of it is hanging out and talking about comedy after the show.
Yeah.
Like, do your shows, but then go with some other comics to a coffee shop and just talk about comedy and comedy theory and just be really, you know, dumb about it. Be nerdy about it. And like, you know,
what's great
that's
is like the reason you often get into comedy is because you're not getting laid. And then when you stay and talk about comedy with other comics, you continue to not get laid.
Yeah. That's right.
And that helps you keep writing material.
Yeah, forever.
It's a wonderful cycle.
Yeah. To chase the unattainable carrot.
Do you feel like that you have to have a certain amount of dissatisfaction in order to be a comic?
I feel like, and maybe I oversimplify things, but if I follow my kind of authenticity rule, I personally deal a lot with that in life. And I think a lot of people do. I don't know if you have to, but I guess what I'm saying is if I'm being authentic, then I'm acknowledging the dissatisfaction that I'm feeling with life.
Mm-hmm.
And there I find comedy. But maybe there's someone who is very, very slightly dissatisfied with life or doesn't have that problem. I don't know if they come up with comedy.
Well, then the follow-up question is, do you feel like you maybe unconsciously generate dissatisfaction with things that are probably fine because you need to analyze, break down, you know, create it?
I think I probably did that before I did comedy, but it's that kind of causation thing. Is it A causes B, B causes A, or C is the external cause of both A and B or something? You know what I mean? And I think it's kind of, I might fall in the camp where I haven't quite found a way to mine my pain so directly and literally that I can make that kind of comedy. And I don't think I'm stuck in that trap yet of like, oh man, I got to go live hard so I can talk about my adventures and make that my content. I'm not in a direct cannibalizing kind of cycle yet. I don't know if I ever will be. So I like escapism. And I think most of my stuff is I still like to escape into thinking and like kind of those kinds of
things. I guess
games.
I'm just digging around to find out because I feel like something that I've noticed about myself lately is that, you know, I might analyze things or pick things apart that are perfectly fine, even just like personal situations.
Yeah.
And I think it's because I'm so conditioned between comedy and also the work that I do and running the stuff that I run of like constantly having to give notes, constantly having to analyze things with comedy, constantly trying to deconstruct and figure out that. I mean, it's almost, I find sometimes that with personal situations, it's sort of like smashing a toaster, taking it apart, and then trying to fit it back together when it was a perfectly fine toaster before.
I think there's something to what you're saying. If you were a professional basketball player, your brain and body would have to be used, the amount of hours you have in a day, you'd have to direct it to that.
Yeah.
And you would literally build up those muscles and neural pathways, I think, in a very different way. And instead, you have a career, all of us here have one, that is a very different use of our time, brain, energy, and focus. And I think it does start to fold onto itself. And it's like, you know what I mean? I read this great book about neuroplasticity, I don't know, 5-7 years ago. And it was so interesting because I don't remember a lot of it and I didn't understand fair amounts of it.
That's kind of a joke right there. I read a joke about neuroplasticity and I don't remember a lot.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it was 5 or 8, 10 years ago.
I know my head's plastic. No, but one of the gists of the book was they used to think that when you're a kid, of course, your brain is pliable and open, and there's so many different ways you can go. But as you age, it starts to cement, and things can't change. It's harder to learn language and so on and so forth. And the, while a lot of that is true, I don't think to the degree that they thought it was.
Okay, good.
So it's like the choices you make and the behaviors that you engage in, they actually literally, physically change the shape of your brain and the neural pathways by repeated behaviors. So putting aside questions of free will and what you can choose and not choose to do, let's just say you can choose to do certain things. It's really interesting. Like you actually reinforce those behaviors and everything. So it's interesting to hear you saying that, because I think that might be a legitimate thing.
I think there is some sort of a weird kind of like subconscious auto-determinism. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the older you get, the more energy it takes to perform a lot of tasks. And so you just create shortcuts. You don't expend as much energy as you would expend before to try to create new pathways. And that's why people get comfortable and protected and like, ah, fuck new things. I don't have the energy for new things.
Comfort. I mean, there's comfort and certainty for sure.
Yeah.
This was a fun podcast. You have to come back. I definitely come back on when your book comes out.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It's good to see you, Demetri Martin, person. Yeah. Demetri Martin, stand-up comedian. Is available now. You're fine.
What's happening to you,
now
Chris?
We're going to check in with traffic.
Chris, your nose
Matt Meyer, what's going out there on the 5 freeway?
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, it's backed up all the way to the
Matt,
10.
Come on.
By the way, congrats on your hour, Chris.
Thank you.
It was nice to do them very close to each other in time.
Thank you. Oh, you can't hear this.
No, I can't. What's happening?
Go ahead and do your traffic report.
Well, the 405 is backed up to the 10. Looks like a lot of traffic going off La Cienega. Oh, over here. Oh, looks like there's an incident over on the 101.
It's not working. I have to keep hitting the button, so it keeps sounding like your engine is stalling every 3 seconds.
Matt, get out, Matt.
We're dropping here. We're dropping pretty fast. Oh, that blade's kicking. Oh, boy.
Oh, Matt, the engines are down.
No, yeah, we're going down fast. There's got to be a big holdup right here.
Anyway, thanks for tuning in to Sky 5. I don't know where the explosion button is.
Kablam! Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.